I'm Brooke Gladstone, and on this week's On the Media, the case for and against drones. The White House says
these strikes are legal, they are ethical, and they are wise.
While the detractors say
we need a long-term understanding and not just a short-term assessment of, oh, the drone killed this bad person, so it must be good.
Also on this week's show, we unpack a couple of rebranding efforts. First, the word jihad.
You might see an image of a girl in a hijab lifting up a dumbbell and the words, my jihad is to stay fit despite my busy schedule.
And that elevator music company wants to drop the name Muzak. We hear from a fan of the genre.
Anytime you try to defend it or think of theories about why it's so good, that's like being a communist in the 1950s.
There's more On the Media coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. To some, drones are an elegant way to minimize collateral damage and American casualties. To others, drones are extrajudicial killing machines, raining death on both civilians and combatants with almost no oversight. Whatever your opinion of drones, they were hard to ignore this week. It started Monday.
NBC News has obtained a government document that lays out the legal argument to justify the president's use of drones to kill al-Qaeda suspects, including, in some cases, U.S. citizens.
This was the first real glimpse at the U.S. government's justification of any part of its drone policy. While it's widely known that the U.S. uses drones in the Middle East and Africa, until this week, it was very rarely acknowledged. During Tuesday's press briefing, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney defended the drone policy.
We conduct those strikes because they are necessary to mitigate ongoing actual threats, to stop plots, prevent future attacks, and again, save American lives. These strikes are legal, they are ethical, and they are wise.
But when asked to clarify what the government considers an imminent threat it says is worthy of a drone strike, he ducked.
I would point you to the now released, it was not meant for public release, but it's not classified, the now released white paper, which goes into some detail on that very issue.
Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Committee on Intelligence, released a statement saying, "The committee continues to seek the actual legal opinions by the Department of Justice that provides details not outlined in this particular white paper." On Wednesday, the White House agreed to hand over the papers requested by Feinstein, probably to ease the confirmation of Chief Counterterrorism Advisor John Brennan as the new director of the CIA. Brennan actually has spoken about the use of drones. Here he is in a 2012 speech at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars.
There is nothing in international law that bans the use of remotely piloted aircraft for this purpose or that prohibits us from using lethal force against our enemies outside of an active battlefield, at least when the country involved consents or is unable or unwilling to take action against the threat.
While Brennan says there's little evidence that the strikes are causing widespread anti-American sentiment, retired General Stanley McChrystal, who once led the military in Afghanistan, recently said that the strikes are, quote, hated on a visceral level and that the resentment they engender is greater than Americans know. At Brennan's Senate confirmation hearing Thursday, he faced tough questions about the White House's reluctance to address civilian casualties. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden.
If the executive branch makes a mistake and kills the wrong person or a group of the wrong people, how should the government acknowledge that?
I believe we need to acknowledge it. We need to acknowledge it publicly.
The first reported drone strike against al-Qaeda took place in Yemen in 2002. Reportedly during the Bush years, there was an American drone strike in Pakistan every 43 days. During the first 2 years of the Obama administration, there was a strike every 4 days. But how many have died as a result, and who are they? In the last few years, the New America Foundation, the Long War Journal, and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism have each sought answers by extrapolating from news accounts of drone strikes. And they each found that the estimates of the U.S. government, which tend to number civilian deaths in the single digits, are far too low. At the end of 2011, a law clinic at Stanford University believed it could get a better accounting by conducting interviews on the ground in the place most targeted by drone strikes, northwest Pakistan. So Stanford partnered with New York University and sent students there. Stanford law professor James Cavallaro helped lead the project. Their findings, called Living Under Drones, were released in September 2012.
What we were hoping to add to the mix were individual accounts of particular strikes based on interviews with victims, witnesses, survivors in the region in North Waziristan most frequently targeted. And we were able to cross that information with other data from media sources, from governmental sources, and provide thick accounts of a number of drone strike incidents. And the other thing that we found a good deal of information about the consequences to communities of living with drones overhead, firing missiles down at unknown times where the people on the ground don't know who is going to be hit, and so they don't know what is going to look like suspected terrorist or militant behavior. And we found psychological disorders, post-traumatic stress disorders. We found a breakdown in the communities. Parents told us they don't send their kids to school. People don't go to religious services. They don't go to group meetings. They are very suspicious of each other. In effect, an entire area of Pakistan has been turned into a war zone, even though in theory the United States is not at war with Pakistan.
In addition to the numbers being off, you found that the larger media narrative is also off because it offers a binary accounting. The dead are either civilians or they're militants. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is the relevant inquiry is whether or not a particular person, as a matter of law, can be the subject of a targeted strike. Can you kill someone? And instead of answering that question, what the media has done, in part following the lead of intelligence sources both in the United States and Pakistan, is to ask whether or not someone is a militant. So let me give you an analogy. Suppose a police officer in New York or Chicago shot and killed a young man. And the only media inquiry was whether or not the young man might have participated in a gang. That wouldn't be adequate by any stretch of the imagination. The question is, was that person presenting a threat at the time he was shot by the police officer? Did he have a weapon? Was there an imminence to the danger presented or not? Because if there wasn't, at most, you can arrest that person. And the same principles apply in areas outside of war zones. And if there is no imminent threat, the United States cannot kill the person and then legitimate it by saying this person was a militant. Reporting what an anonymous official says without challenging that, I think borders on irresponsible. I don't think the media would apply the same standards in the U.S.
Are you at all reassured that the president apparently signs off on all the kill lists?
I am not, and for two reasons. One, the kill lists are relevant only to what are known as personality strikes, which are strikes that target particular known individuals. The data show that those strikes are responsible for only 2% of those killed. The vast majority of Hellfire missiles raining down from drones are signature strikes. What that means is rather than having a specific individual, you have drone operators looking at screens of video coming in from drones flying overhead areas where militants or others are believed to operate. They identify behavior that allows drone operators to conclude that the people are militants and should be killed. So close to 98%, maybe more, of those who are killed are either low-level militants or civilians. And these are people who are not subject to review by the president.
What do you think about what's happened this week? Has that moved the issue at all? First, you have this white paper, as narrow as its focus is, being leaked to NBC. You have hearings in which the prospective head of the CIA, John Brennan, who is apparently the architect of the drone program, has been interviewed. Do you think that this will shake loose any more information?
I think the events of the past week have been very important and they're encouraging. It's good that we see the white paper and that the other memoranda be released to congressional committees. Their contents are very disconcerting. Moving forward, I think we need two things. One is we need much greater transparency. But two, it's not enough for the administration to say, these are what we think the standards are. The administration and U.S. forces need to comply with the law. And there is strong evidence that that has not been the case to date.
Now you've done the research, you've released a report, you've corrected some facts. What difference does it make? Do you think U.S. support for military drones is the result of people not fully understanding the impact that they have?
Yes, I think that's a big factor. I think we have collectively accepted a narrative that is not accurate. As we provide more information, as we see that the standards that the administration has been using, even for U.S. citizens, are fuzzy and depart from international and U.S. norms, as we see increasing evidence of civilian deaths, as we see that drones and drone strikes foster recruitment to al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups that seek to do damage to the United States, and as we see our own democratic process suffer the consequences of excessive secrecy, we're more likely to reach the conclusion that, on the whole, the drone program is of more harm than it is benefit to our efforts to stop terrorism.
You're positive that more information would turn people against the drone program. It's possible that other information, for instance, fewer American soldiers put at risk, the lower costs, will convince significant members of the public that this is a pretty good deal.
A lot of this depends on what facts are out there. It's true that drones reduce the cost in the short term to the men and women in the United States military forces, the CIA, and other governmental agents. That said, if indeed drones create significant anti-American hostility, and there are data on this, for instance, 74% of Pakistanis consider the United States an enemy. 90-something percent of Pakistanis have a negative understanding of the drones. And during the period of drone use in Pakistan, anti-Americanism has increased. So in the mid-term and in the long term, it may well be that even if drones occasionally hit a particular high-level terrorist target, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that drones serve as a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups who seek to do damage to the United States and to Americans. We need a long-term understanding and not just a short-term assessment of, oh, the drone killed this bad person, so it must be good.
Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jim Cavallaro is professor of law and director of the Stanford International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. We'll link to their report, Living Under Drones, on our website. Coming up, when is a jihad not a jihad? And when is elevator music not Muzak? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few words about words. Many political pundits say the recent election marks a turning point for Democrats and Republicans, and new times call for new vocabulary. For instance, Cecile Richards, the president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, says her organization has decided to drop the phrase pro-choice. She told WNYC's Brian Lehrer recently that polls suggest the once potent term now just muddies the waters, especially for Republicans who are pro-choice. I mean, in favor of abortion rights.
What we're found, it's actually fascinating, stronger support in this country than ever for the Roe decision, for women to be able to make their own decisions about their pregnancies, but just less affinity for a label that, frankly, is a political label that was created decades ago.
Maybe the activists of the Roe v. Wade generation needed a rallying cry, but Richard says that the young people, they don't like labels. Labels are political. They hurt the cause.
Whether it's pro-choice, pro-life, whether it is sexuality, sexual preference, sexual identity. And I think this is more recognition that just these sort of shorthand labels don't necessarily reflect how people talk about and think about issues that are very important.
When asked for an alternative shorthand, she didn't have one. Instead, she offered a full sentence stating the Planned Parenthood position. Maybe this heralds a new day, but it's hard to imagine that political phrase-making is dead, especially since rebranding is in full and furious swing. Last fall, we spoke to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas, who recently came out as an undocumented immigrant. He's suffered the consequences, but he's also found a cause, stamping out the phrase illegal alien.
As if I just landed there from Mars. Can you think of any other instance that we refer to a group of people as illegal in this country? Actions are illegal, not people.
Eliminating the phrase won't eliminate injustice, won't ensure civil rights for people like him, but it's powerfully symbolic, and the media, he says, have to know that.
This one word comes with this kind of journalistic question of how can we be as accurate and as descriptive as possible? And I'm sorry to say this, as far as I'm concerned, illegal immigrant and illegal alien are neither of those things.
What he is, what most Americans were when they first got here, is an immigrant, in his case, without papers, an undocumented immigrant, a person with a problem.
I'm not what you think I am. We are not who you think we are. We're not the other people. We're actually one of you. That's why this is not just wordplay. This is actually at the heart of this conversation. What we're called and why we're called what we're called.
Which brings us to the last in our series of tendentious terminology. This week, a 21-year-old student from Bangladesh pled guilty to attempting to blow up the Federal Reserve Bank in Lower Manhattan as part of an FBI sting. He wrote that he wanted to destroy America. Agents of the Joint Terrorism Task Force wrote that he wanted to advance the goals of jihad. Jihad. That tells us all we need to know, right? Actually, a growing number of Muslims are trying to reclaim the word, return it to its original nonviolent definition, attempting, if you will, to rebrand it. WNYC's Arun Venugopal reports on the struggle to reappropriate jihad.
A long, long, long time ago, when I was in college, I hung out with some friends who were in the Muslim Students Association, the MSA. And one day they had a mixer of sorts with one of the Christian student groups, of which there were several, this being Texas. And one of the first things the Christians asked the Muslims about was jihad. They wanted to know what that was all about, because clearly they'd heard a thing or two. And almost as if on cue, the Muslims are all, "Great question! And hey, we've got the perfect person to answer it for you. As a matter of fact, get this, his name is Jihad." And all eyes turn to Jihad, this perfectly earnest, gentle 18-year-old boy, a freshman with a big, sweet smile. Jihad delivers this mini-lecture about his name, about Jihad, and how it's an internal struggle that can sometimes manifest itself as a physical struggle or an act of self-defense. I was the only Hindu in the room. I don't remember much of what he said because, for me, the fascinating thing was watching this exchange. I remember thinking that the Christians did not appear entirely convinced. For these kids, jihad had different associations. In countless movies like True Lies from 1994.
"Unless you, America, pulls all military forces out of the Persian Gulf area immediately and forever, Crimson Jihad will rain fire on one major U.S. city each week until our demands are met."
For any American, this is what jihad meant. Amet Rehab is a Muslim-American activist in Chicago. His day job is running the local chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. He got so tired of the overwhelmingly violent image of jihad that he started a campaign to, as he said, reclaim the word. Not just from Muslim extremists, but from Western Islamophobes. He first turned to friends on Facebook and asked them to join him on Twitter. He wanted everyone to share their greatest dreams with the rest of the world and their most intensely personal struggles, the kind of things they grapple with on a daily basis. And he came up with the hashtag, #MyJihad.
I began by explaining that as a young boy, I remember my grandmother, who was quadriplegic and diabetic, who had been bedridden for 7 years plus. And I remember feeling very sorry for her and wondering how she could deal with this challenge for so long. And I asked her, "Grandma, how is it that you put through with this?" And her answer really made me think. She said, "Well, my son, it's my jihad."
The My Jihad campaign started rolling out ads on the sides of buses in Chicago a few months ago, followed by San Francisco and then Washington, D.C. So you might see an image of a girl in a hijab lifting up a dumbbell and the words, "My jihad is to stay fit despite my busy schedule." Or a young mom who says, "My jihad is to march on despite losing my son." Rehab thinks of his campaign as a kind of icebreaker for the community, one that'll make it easier for Muslims to use this word without fear.
Muslims were intimidated because of what they hear in the public sphere, in the media included, of this constant bashing of jihad and this constant misdefinition of the term that was rendered exclusively to represent criminals.
By which he means terrorists who operate in the name of Islam. But in the 1980s, Americans saw things differently. That's when thousands of men flocked to Afghanistan to serve as holy warriors against the Soviets. They were known as the Mujahideen. They were celebrated by the U.S., as was their notion of jihad. But then, as Time magazine's world editor Bobby Ghosh noted in a recent TED Talk, Osama bin Laden emerged.
And the things he did in the pursuit of this jihad was so monstrous and had such great impact that his definition was the one that stuck. We didn't know any better. We just assumed that if this insane man and his psychopathic followers were calling what they did jihad, then that's what jihad must mean. But it wasn't just us. Even in the Muslim world, his definition of jihad began to gain acceptance.
Is there any precedent for beating back a stigmatized word? I turn to the academic world.
My name is Adam Glinsky. I'm a professor at Columbia University.
He studied the reappropriation of stigmatizing labels. The two most famous examples of this are the Black community's use of the N-word and the word queer.
When Queer Nation came into being, their particular purpose was to reclaim the use of the word and give it sort of a new meaning and a new value.
But words like queer represent identity, which those who have been labeled have worked to redefine and ultimately own. Jihad, however, is an act. How do you redefine an act?
If you want to make it something about self-discovery or self-improvement, you've got to make it easy for people then to incorporate that into their everyday language. If it's too self-conscious, it doesn't work. You know, if you want it to be about self-improvement, you could say, you know, it's like this year on New Year's Eve, I'm going on my jihad with my resolutions.
A dietary jihad, followed by a makeover or style jihad. Galinsky is skeptical about the chances for jihad crossing over into the mainstream unless it goes casual. Think lipstick feminism. But is that possible without sacrificing the word's spiritual essence? Would Muslims take that trade-off? And if so, would it even work? I asked Frank Luntz, Republican political consultant famous for rebranding the estate tax as a death tax, among other semantic feats. How would he respond to the job of repositioning jihad?
My response would be, are you nuts? No. And trying to make people feel better about jihad? Trying to make people feel better about a holy war? Jihad is a violent, destructive, murderous word, and no campaign and no amount of money is going to change that.
Nevertheless, Rehab says his campaign is catching on in the Muslim community, and Muslims in Norway and Australia and elsewhere also want to give it a try. Naeem Baig, the head of the Islamic Circle of North America, said Rehab and the others are taking a very American approach to the problem, openly confronting something that's clearly got some serious baggage. And he seems to approve. But this isn't just a campaign about a word. Rehab says he wants to draw ordinary Muslims out of the shadows, to get them to speak up for Islam and ultimately drown out the haters and extremists.
When we talk about Sharia, it's chopping of hands. When we talk about Islam, it's about marrying four women. It's about blowing things up and getting 72 virgins in heaven. This caricature. When it comes to Islam, we are in a dumbed down sphere. We need to come out of that. This is what this campaign will do. It will help us get to this rational conversation.
Creating a rational conversation about Islam is going to take a lot more than tweets and bus ads. But it all starts with a single word. For On the Media, I'm Arun Venugopal.
And now we'll examine one last word with a seriously low approval rating. Muzak. We've all mocked it. Elevator music is so bland, it constitutes an insult to real music. We've just heard how hard it will be to rehabilitate the word jihad, but Mood Media, the company that owns Muzak, apparently believes that that word is damaged beyond repair, and this week, it's getting rid of it. The word, that is. The service will be bundled with the rest of the company's offerings under the general rubric Mood. Joseph Lanza is the author of Elevator Music, A Surreal History of Muzak, Easy Listening, and Other Mood Song. Joseph, welcome to On the Media.
Hello.
We thought that maybe during this interview, we would play some of the easy listening hits that you particularly like.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
When we hear the word Muzak, we think of elevators, department stores, waiting rooms, but not the military. And that's where it started, right?
The inventor of Muzak was Major George Owen Squire. He was in the Signal Corps, and he invented something called multiplexing. It allowed more than one signal to transmit on a telephone line. He called it wired wireless, and he used that for communications during the First World War in the area of the Philippines to try to relay messages. And near his retirement, he decided to apply this technology to a music service. He wanted wire communications over the idea of the wireless, the radio, which was popular then. So he created something called Wired Radio in 1922, and he wanted to bring the music straight into people's homes. Later, that didn't prove as practical, but it went into businesses like restaurants, hotels, and as the company moved on, it went into larger places like factories, foundries. In 1934, the company became Muzak, combining the word music with Kodak.
There was a lot of research that Kodak was a word that could be recognized in any language, was
yes.
easy in every language.
It was like an Esperanto word. And it's still, even though the company just recently decided to get rid of the name, Muzak will still be associated with that music that they pumped into our lives for many decades.
This Major General, was he more of a geek, or did he have the idea of the manipulative power of music?
He wanted to really do it as a business, but he also saw this idea of just being able to use music as part of the environment just to help people relax and acclimate. It's the same reason why, in a strange way, why people use the wires in their earbuds today when they're on the subway and they just want to block out this harsh and threatening environment.
Elevator music has been the butt of many jokes, but when elevators were first being adopted, the music actually served a really important purpose.
Elevators were terrifying places to many people. They still are, especially if you're in skyscrapers. In the late 40s, Muzak teamed up with Otis Elevator Company to put out an ad in Time magazine stating that the music by Muzak made the journey on an elevator much more easy, gliding on the notes of a lilting melody.
You wrote that elevators at the turn of the century, they were seen as floating domiciles of disequilibrium.
Yeah, and by the time they became electronic, it was even more so because you didn't have that many elevator operators greeting you. But that wasn't their main business. It was places like factories, workplaces, offices, department stores.
And in restaurants, you noted in your book, they had different music for breakfast. It would be more upbeat, more caffeinated, and then lunchtime would be light classical, and you get the cocktail hour, and so on.
In the early days, they had more of a menu like that, but they developed by the late 40s a system called stimulus progression. And what they would do is they would program the music in 15-minute blocks. The first track would be kind of a slower tempo, a milder sound, and maybe not as much elaborate instruments. And then they would move on, and by the end of the quarter hour, they would make it more up-tempo. It worked best in workplaces because when you had music playing in a very underarranged and not obtrusive setting that built up through quarter hours, worker morale and productivity were a lot better.
What about music for shopping?
They found that if the music was slower, customers would linger longer in aisles. And if you linger longer in aisles, you tend to buy more.
Muzak was also piped into wartime arsenals?
Yes, that was a very tedious work. Later on, they were piped into embassies. There's a great story about 1975 when we gave up on the Vietnam War. It was playing in the embassy in Saigon as people were getting into helicopters to get out of there.
You cite a Muzak programmer who said that, quote, when musicians are left to themselves to make art for the sake of art, not considering public taste, demographics, or psychology, they'll put together something that won't please everyone. My task is to amalgamate tastes. Imagine trying to please 80 or 90 million viewpoints. Did he do it?
I would imagine for many people he did. I personally liked the music. I listened to it for many... you're laughing, but it's true. I mean, I liked it. I liked it both in its form of the background music you'd hear in public, and I liked it on record. I thought this was a great parallel world. You would have your rock or your pop version of a song, and suddenly you would hear this different version of the song living side by side. It was, I call it, an aural depth of field. You don't have that anymore. You go into a retail setting, and it's usually the music that the proprietor of the store likes.
So, obviously, part of the reason Mood Media is shedding the name Muzak is to try and shake off the negative connotations that have come with the word. But do you think it can ever escape its Muzak past? Do you think it should even try?
When I hear this blanket statement from so many people that elevator music is bad or people complaining about Muzak, I can't help to suspect that this is just lazy groupthink. It was so universally disliked, I thought, let me advocate this. And it became a great way of being subversive because anytime you try to defend it or think of theories about why it's so good, that's like almost like being a communist in the 1950s.
It's very transgressive.
Yes, it is.
Joseph, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Joseph Lanza is author of Elevator Music, A Surreal History of Muzak, Easy Listening, and Other Mood Song. Coming up, the very first viral video that featured a fight to the death. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. From little acorns, mighty oaks grow, massive, intrusive oaks. The acorn in this metaphor was the 1996 release of the game Quake, a first-person shooter with a delicious twist. The developers opened up the game's code to players so they could make new levels and even new games. Instead, players began to make movies.
I must have her.
Beware, my friend. She is not property. For your thoughts to become reality, you require mutual consent, or you may find yourself in trouble with the server administrator.
I want to...
Copulate, score, fornicate.
Yes. Yes!
Soon the creators of games like The Sims and World of Warcraft began making their games more friendly to movie makers, and the genre of homemade films based on them was redubbed machinima, a mashup of machine and cinema. In 2000, Scotsman Hugh Hancock registered machinima.com as a hub for like-minded dabblers. In 2006, he sold it to the half-brothers Alan and Philip de Beauvoir. That's when the acorn, in my metaphor, becomes that massive sidewalk-cracking oak. The de Beauvoir began hosting Machinima's videos on YouTube, attracting a massive audience, venture capital, and even throwing throwing the artist some advertising bucks. But for those bucks, many creators had to sign lifetime contracts. The mighty oak is crushing them. Tessa Stewart wrote all about Rage Against the Machinima in the LA Weekly. She says going on YouTube seemed like a great idea at the time.
Right. It was really great timing for Machinima to become one of the first multi-channel networks on YouTube.
The biggest complaint against Machinima is the contracts that it has inked with its partners. Tell me about Ben Vakas.
He started as a hunter in World of Warcraft, a gamer, and began making videos to build on his celebrity within World of Warcraft. He became very popular, and Machinima approached him to become a partner.
They said they would put ads on his videos, and he'd get a cut of the revenue generated from those ads, and Vakas mm-hmm. signed the contract with the company.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess he didn't really read the contract.
He didn't read the contract, and his complaint is indicative of many, many complaints that have surfaced against Machinima, that this contract didn't have an end date. It could only be severed by Machinima, and it wasn't paying him very much.
The company would own the rights to whatever videos he posts on YouTube for the rest of his life and beyond, in perpetuity, throughout the universe, in all forms of media now known or hereafter devised.
They said that my contract is completely enforceable. I can't get out of it. They said I'm with them for the rest of my life, that I'm with them forever. I can't afford a lawyer. They're all the way in California. I'm all the way in England. If I'm locked down to Machinima for the rest of my life, and if I've got no freedom, then I don't want to make videos anymore.
He could have made videos elsewhere and not brought his subscribers with him. But part of the thing that's so interesting about Ben Vakas and his cohorts on YouTube is that they've found a way to really leverage their subscriber base to make the kind of changes that they want to see. They are very PR savvy.
So tell me how the gamer community reacted.
They were outraged. There's another YouTube celebrity known online as Athene. He had been an early Machinima partner, and he felt that this was indicative of a lot of complaints against Machinima.
If things are wrong, I'm not the kind of guy that just ignores it or don't want to go to confrontation. This is a very hard decision, and I've been thinking about it. The only thing that I can do, the only thing that feels right now, is to leave Machinima.
That reverberated through the community with a lot of force.
Because he had more than 500,000 subscribers and something like 382 million views.
He's a bona fide YouTube celebrity. For him to say publicly that he was leaving Machinima was a big deal to the community. The outrage is a trend, and I think Machinima is responding to it by trying to change their contracts. They sent new contracts out that had a fixed term to all 6,000-plus partners. A lot of people felt like they were being walked from contracts that were not enforceable into contracts that were enforceable.
So now they're offering termination dates so that they can actually enforce contracts that are unfair in other ways.
That's what a lot of lawyers say.
You compared the practices of these big YouTube networks to the practices of Hollywood in the 30s and 40s.
In the early days of the Hollywood studio system, the studios were not just making the films, they also owned the means of distribution for the films. Films had a much shorter theatrical run at that point, so more films had to be made as quickly as possible. The studios felt like they couldn't negotiate contracts one by one with each star, so they would put stars on an option contract. It was usually a term of 7 years, and if the studio was happy with them, they would renew the option, but the star couldn't break the contract. It was seen as a form of bondage. It was the source of several lawsuits. The Olivia de Havilland lawsuit was probably the most famous one. She was on an option contract. I believe it was with Warner Brothers. They kept offering her these more supporting roles, and she didn't like them, and she couldn't go anywhere else.
He has grown greedier with the years. The first time, he only wanted my money. Now he wants my love, too.
Maybe Vakas sees himself as the modern equivalent of Olivia de Havilland. After the world got to hear the sorrows of young Vakas, what happened to him?
In October, he was released from his contract with Machinima, but only after he had a lawyer negotiate on his behalf. He has a new channel, and he has a banner on his old channel telling his old subscribers, click here to my new channel. He's with a new network called Union for Gamers that has taken a lot of former Machinimators.
How do networks like Machinima address the allegations that they're making money off the backs of young, naive YouTube stars?
Well, they say that they are subsidizing the careers of a lot of non-YouTube stars, that they sign YouTube stars when they're obscure, and as they become bigger, they might demand more money, but they're still signing other people who are obscure and paying them to advertise on their videos. Machinima is struggling to find a contract that can serve both the stars and the lesser-known partners.
Do you think if Olivia de Havilland had had YouTube, she could have made an appeal and not had her career destroyed?
I think she could have, yeah. If you can leverage the massive fan base that you have access to through YouTube, I think a lot of things are possible.
Tessa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Tessa Stewart wrote Rage Against Machinima for the LA Weekly, where she was a writer. Now she's a reporter for BuzzFeed. In 1995, the internet was in its infancy. Cell phones were the size of your head, and VHS tapes were all the rage. It would take over a decade until YouTube and viral videos became a mainstay of our online lives. And yet, viral videos began in this decidedly analog year. Your dancing cats, your kids babbling after the dentist, your double rainbows, they all have their roots in an underground video sensation from 1995. Independent producer J.P. Davidson brings us this story of viral videos, Patient Zero.
Viral videos have completely changed the way we think about mainstream media. But how did we get here? Who was the patient zero for viral videos? The story starts with these two film students who raised $125,000 to produce their first feature-length film. The true story of Alfred Packer, an 1870s prospector accused of cannibalism.
Yes, the snow is deep.
It was a unique subject, especially for a musical.
And maybe we'll all get really sick. And maybe we'll all die.
So let's build a snowman. We can make him our best friend.
They finished the movie over spring break and submitted it to the Sundance Film Festival. And it was rejected. So they rented a banquet hall in one of the festival hotels and put on their own screening. And it turns out that one of the people lured into that unofficial screening was an executive from Fox Studios.
My name is Brian Grayton, and I've been a television executive for a lot of years, first at Fox, and then later running MTV and VH1.
Brian loved the movie. So when our two filmmakers graduated and moved to Hollywood, Brian did his best to help them out.
We developed a couple of pilots with them, and nothing really, you know, got off the ground beyond the pilot stage. And so it got to be around Christmas time, and I remember the guy sort of needed, you know, cash to pay rent. And so I said, why don't you do a Christmas card for me, a little video that I'll send out to, you know, a couple hundred contacts in the industry.
So the guys went home and set to work on Brian's video Christmas card.
So they come back 2 weeks later. I want to say it's probably early December at this point. And I remember this as distinctly as yesterday. They walked into our sort of open office pit area, and there were probably 10 or 15 of us that worked in that open area. So we all came out and sort of gravitated to the TV and popped it in, and, you know, never laughed so hard in my life as I did during those 5 minutes.
But Brian started to have second thoughts about sending it out to all his TV industry contacts.
I loved it, but it was so inappropriate that I think I reduced my list from like 200 to maybe 30 people.
There was a lot of swearing in this animated Christmas card. Also, a fight to the death between Santa Claus and Jesus Christ.
You have blemished the meaning of Christmas for the last time, Kringle.
I bring happiness and love to children all over the world.
Christmas is for celebrating my birth.
Christmas is for giving.
I'm here to put an end to your blasphemy.
This time we finish it. There can be only one.
You stepped on my foot, you p***. Dude, don't say p*** in front of Jesus.
So by now you may have guessed that our two filmmakers are Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the creators of the wildly successful animated series, South Park. As unlikely as it seemed at the time,
Brian's Christmas card was their ticket to success, about to become the world's first viral video. But how? We're still only in 1995 here, and YouTube won't even exist for another 10 years. Remember, we're talking about sending out VHS tapes by snail mail. And it wasn't even going to Brian's most important TV industry contacts anymore.
So as opposed to even industry contacts, it ended up just going to my friends. But even that backfired because some of them had little kids. I want to say it went to like 37, 38 people, something like that.
And then it's the holidays, and he's away for a few weeks.
It wasn't until I came back and popped by a couple of agents' offices where they said, oh my God, you have to see this video. And they popped in what clearly was a 17th generation dub of the Christmas video. Nobody even knew where it came from necessarily or had an accurate story.
The video just kept spreading. People all over Hollywood were manually copying VHS tapes and making copies of the copies and copies of those copies. And somehow, one of the copies traveled over 1,000 miles to Dallas, Texas. That's where Jay Krybek was working, fresh out of college, at a video game studio.
I don't know this for sure, but I believe the person in question worked either for Nintendo or was a client of Nintendo. But at some point, you know, during the visit, he pulled this tape out of his bag. He's like, hey, you guys should watch this. It's hysterical. And, you know, of course, we're all dying laughing. And it was like, hey, you know, that was awesome. And a couple guys asked for copies. I was not one of them. But about a week later, people were still talking about it.
So Jay made a few copies of this mystery tape as Christmas gifts for his friends. Sure, he got the tape for free, but it's the thought that counts, right?
You know, I had to go out and buy mailers and, you know, walk down to the post office and get $2.50 or whatever, put out each envelope. And I mean, you know, come on. This is not like, oh, that was funny. Copy, open Facebook, paste, done. You know, I mean, it took work.
Now, this is Christmas 1996, a full year after Brian sent out the original videotapes in Hollywood. Glacially slow by today's viral video standards. But things were about to speed up. One of the friends Jay sent the video to was still in college back in Illinois.
That was 2 or 3 years after the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, which is where all of us went to school, had installed networks in the dorms. And so somebody digitized the film and stuck it up on their personal computer in the dorm.
The video created a huge spike in the dorm's internet traffic.
The poor guys in their dorm room, I mean, thousands of downloads on this 53 meg file, which, you know, back then, that was still something, right?
Apparently, the guy hosting the file had to buy a second computer to actually get any schoolwork done. So how did a dorm room in Illinois become ground zero for a viral video revolution?
The first web browser that was just, you know, download and use it was NTSA Mosaic. That web browser was developed at the University of Illinois.
Students at the University of Illinois were among the first in the country to combine fast internet connections with easy-to-use browser software.
It was all happening right in front of us. We were maybe 6 months to a year ahead of everyone else.
But back in Hollywood, Brian, Matt, and Trey were struggling to get the South Park series off the ground. Finally, a small, relatively new cable channel said they'd finance the pilot. So in a huge act of faith, Brian left Fox to work on the pilot for Comedy Central with Matt and Trey.
I went from a job at Fox where everyone returned your calls to working above a little grocery store with Matt and Trey every day.
It ended up taking over a year to finish the first episode. And when it was finally done, they still had a huge hurdle to overcome before the network would order more episodes. The focus group.
Rating I'd ever seen in my life until that point or since. And I remember a lot of people gave it ones out of tens. I remember 2 or 3 women started crying because they said it was just too inappropriate to have children say those kinds of things. So I thought at that point we were doomed. I had to kind of tell the guys that this doesn't look good. And I remember kind of being, you know, a little heartbroken over it.
It was crushing. Women had cried. So as they walked into the meeting with Comedy Central, Brian, Matt, and Trey braced themselves to be dropped by the network.
And really to our astonishment, they said, well, we still think it's funny, so let's take a flyer on 6. And had we went with a major network, I think they couldn't have done that. The Comedy Central at the time really had nothing to lose.
So the little cable channel with nothing to lose ordered 6 episodes. Those guys with the Christmas video had gotten a show.
Where it really hit me, what had happened was when we premiered, because we premiered in the August, that would be a year and a half after the Christmas video went out, almost a year and 8 months. And you know, Comedy Central did a little tiny advertising on their little tiny cable channel, but that wasn't going to reach many people. But the premiere rating was the highest rating ever to that point in cable for any series. Well, none of us could explain that, and then we figured out that the video had literally went to so many people that had been the marketing for it. So it really was the first, in a way, viral marketing campaign. We just hadn't been clever enough to engineer it, but that's really what had happened. And I really found out by talking to college kids who were like younger than Trey, Matt, and I at that time, because all of them had seen it, because colleges just had those T1 lines for internet, and that's where tons and tons of kids had seen it in that second year after it was released.
Brian remembers it was a strange feeling.
Sort of surreal. There was a moment I remember with, I can't remember if Matt and Trey were with me or not, but I was walking through Times Square maybe 8 weeks after the show premiered, and in every single shop I passed, there was counterfeit South Park merchandise. We hadn't done a single license yet, but everywhere was Cartman something, and just shop after shop after shop. And they were on the cover of Newsweek, if I remember right. And I remember thinking, this is the weirdest. It's like in one of those movies where the newspaper starts spinning with the headlines out of nowhere.
South Park may never have come to be without those college kids, especially the ones in Illinois. For his part, Jay Krybek just saw something he liked, and he followed that same tug we all feel when we share something new and exciting on Facebook or Twitter or Tumblr.
This is so awesome, and I found it, and I'm going to be the one to share it with you.
Finally, Jay says he's happy for Brian, Matt, and Trey. He's glad he could contribute to their success, but...
Well, I was a critical link in the chain that eventually led to this, you know, multi-million dollar media empire that Trey and Matt have. So I figure that they owe me about $6. And if I ever run across them, I'm going to say, hey, you owe me a beer.
J.P. Davidson is an independent radio producer in Toronto, Canada. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, and it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Frankel. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.